Welcome, welcome from Alpha, from Alpha to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 58th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Saturday, the 3rd of January, 2015, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week's show is sponsored by the new and very generous monthly subscriber, Jesse L, the very generous once-off donations of Anders A and James O.B., and the repeat donation from Joan O.B. Thanks one and all. You too can kick off the new year in a generous mode by clicking on that there donate button on the podcast website. Also, a big shout out to all of you who left a review for the show over on iTunes. They are GDDFCY and Senon K in Ireland, Precious J in the UK, Swoozy Moonshine, Peter in China 2, and El Caballero 34 in the US, Star Star Hash Hash XX in Canada, Simeon Pilgrim over in New Zealand. Some of the reviews were extremely kind, and I had to quickly apply a compress to my head to stop the dramatic swelling. If I was to read them all out, I would surely become unbearable. So a blanket thank you to all of you reviewers. You too can help to grow the show's listenership by leaving a review on the show's iTunes website. The instructions on how to do this are contained in the show notes. Also, I only just realised that iTunes only shows the reviews for the country you are in, which is a bit of a pain in the gluteus maximus. So I didn't realise there were all these reviews until just the other day. It's pretty difficult to try and check all the countries for the reviews, so if I have skipped your country and hence missed your review, just send me a quick email and I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You may also be interested in a promising new podcast that has just been launched by Amog Sadhu and C. Derek Varn called Symptomatic Redness. It features a really good interview Amog did with me earlier in the autumn, where I am the one giving my opinions on all things economic and political, and where I slander all my previous guests. I've included the link in the show notes. You should check it out. This week, I'm delighted to welcome Sean Michael Wilson to the show. Sean Michael is a Scottish comic book writer who now lives and works in Japan. In the last couple of years, he has released a couple of explicitly political graphic novels. Paracomic, the story of Michael Albert and participatory economics, with an intro by Noam Chomsky. And Fight the Power, a visual history of protests among the English-speaking people, with an intro by Tariq Ali. He has also recently wrote a post for the Forbidden Planet blog on how an anarchy-based economic system would benefit the creation of comics and all art in general. We discuss the creative process of the comic book world, the emergence of adult-themed comic books, The Walking Dead and its Hobbesian view of the world, why Hollywood does not do anarchy-inspired films, progressive politics in comics, socialism and the world of art, and the desperate need we have for revolutionary jokes. To the interview. So, Sean Michael, how did you end up getting into the world of comics?
I got into it like most kids did when of my age, because everybody used to read comic books. I was a kid, I'm 45 now, and so in the 70s and until about the mid-late 80s, almost all kids in Scotland, anyway, and everywhere else in Britain and Ireland too, read comic books. So I just read comic books in the same way. But then I started to get into the more mature comic books when I was quite young, when I was 13.
Where did you get access to these kind of comic books?
Well, 2000 AD was the big kind of slightly mature comic at that time. But then me and my pals, Edinburgh, we used to read that religiously, so to speak. But then Warrior came out and Escape came out, and those are two books that don't exist anymore now, although Paul Gravatt has started his Escape publishing company again recently, and they opened my eyes in an amazing way to the fact that comic books could be about mature themes and sophisticated themes. They can be stories for adults. When you explain that, the problem with my situation is because I'm a politically radical, which most people have no idea about, and I'm a comic book writer, which most people have no idea about. So I spend half my time explaining myself, you know. So the thing about comics in Britain is that we think of it as being inherently for children, which is definitely wrong. It's never been inherently for children. Comic books is just, you know, the combination of words and pictures. There's absolutely no reason why combining words and pictures together would be inherently for children. So you can mature type stories with them. And that doesn't mean pornography. Because when you say, oh, my comic books are not for kids, I do comic books for adults, half the people immediately think, oh, do you mean porn? I say, no, not porn. Just sophisticated stories. I've always thought of comic books as being like a wonderful art form, and I wanted to do them since I was 12 years old. So for me, doing them now is a kind of a childhood dream come true.
And so you're a writer then, more than an artist?
I'm a writer, yeah. Of course, that's the other thing. Not only people not know what comic books are about more mainly, but they don't know how they're made. So the basic thing is a comic book writer obviously comes up with ideas and writes a script. And script is a little bit like a film script. And you pass that to the artist, and the artist then physically draws it by pen or computer, normally a mixture of the two, to your guideline. So being a comic book writer is a little bit like being a novel writer and a film director put together. That you actually come up with the words, but you also decide the directions to your actor, which in this case is the artist. And you together as a very tight team. That's how it works, basically.
So do you have to, in some kind of way, storybook your writing, or is that more the process of the artist?
Oh, you can do it. It works in different ways. One of the ways of doing it is the writer just describes the basic plot and maybe breaks it down to the page, and then you can give that to the artist, and that's pretty much a prose description. The other way is to do it in a more detailed, full script way, as it's called, in which you break it down to each panel. Of course, the panel is the frames, that, you know, the little squares or rectangle shape boxes with in which the art happens. So you can describe on a full script what happens in each particular panel, so that you can say, for instance, what you and I are doing now. You describe it to the artist. There's one guy in Japan and there's one guy in Britain talking on the computers to each other. And you describe the visuals. And you could describe what's the nature of the relationship between them. You could describe the facial expressions, the hand gestures. So that sounds like what an actor does with an actor in a movie. So you can, as a writer, you can describe it right down to the detailed elements of the psychology, who's saying what, why, what's the place of that panel within the page, what's the place of the page within the whole story. So it's very detailed. So it can happen at any level, depending on what the artist and the writer are comfortable with. Just like filmmaking can happen in different ways.
Is it a different thing to write dialogue for a comic than it is, say, for a TV or a film script? Does the medium change the nature of the dialogue?
Yeah, it does. If you're writing something for a television or a film script, I've done film. I did films before I came back to my first love, comic books, and I had a couple of things on Channel 4. The thing about that is, of course, you've got to think about the sound more in films. Obviously, there is sound in films, and there's not in comic books. So there's just words to represent sound. And filmmaking often has a kind of, it has a type of script where you're not supposed to put in directions. So as a writer, you can concentrate mainly on the dialogue and very, very basic directions as to what's happening where. And then the director will make a second version of that script in which they put in those directing type aspects. But as a comic book writer, you kind of combine both. That's why I say it's a little bit like making a film and it's a little bit like making a novel. But it's not like a kind of bastard version of those two. Comic book writing is its own specific type of writing And it's a much more sophisticated and complicated type of writing than people think it is. I'm not saying that to blow my own trumpet. I'm talking about all comic book writing. It's much more sophisticated and satisfying a type of writing than people realize.
So you're living in Japan now. How did you end up there? Or is it to do with writing?
People ask me that and I always wonder, shall I tell them the real reason or say it's about writing? It was about the ladies. one particular lady I came over with, a Japanese lady that I met in London, as a matter of fact. So we came back to Japan together, but it was also in order for me to try and get into the Japanese manga industry. So it was both reasons. And I've been lucky enough, and also I've worked hard at it, that I've managed to get two or three different contracts to work for Tokyo Publishers. And I'm the only British professional comic book writer who lives in Japan. And that's a bit weird, actually. When I realized I was the only one here, I thought, that's weird. How is it no one else has come over? But I'm the only one. Although, as a matter of fact, there's another guy here right now. He's come over just for a week for an exhibition in Tokyo, but then he's off back to Britain again. But apart from him, I'm the only one.
Who were the big influences on your comic book style?
The biggest influence by far is Alan Moore, who many people will know from V for Vendetta and From Hell and Watchmen. That have all been made into films, which all of which are not as good as the original books. And he's overwhelmingly the biggest influence on me. Of course, I like some Japanese manga creators too, like Tatsumi. But I was into these British writers before the Japanese ones, and those ones are still closest to my heart. Also, Grant Morrison is very influential on me. He's a Scottish writer. And another Scottish guy is Eddie Campbell, who is an artist and a writer. And for me, I love their work so much that it's the kind of thing, comic books doesn't really make you a lot of money. It's a mass art form, but it's not the kind of thing that makes a lot of money for the creators in general, just a medium amount if you're lucky. But the kind of creative inspiration that these writers and these artists inculcated in me when I was a teenager is still there now and inspires me to get up every morning and do my own stuff.
I used to be a big comic hound when I was a kid, an avid collector of all these American, mostly superhero kind of comics. I didn't really know of any of these more mature adult stuff. You were young when you found out this stuff. Did you have a really good comic shop near you or something?
No, what happened is me and my pal David, we were walking in Leith Walk in Edinburgh, and a guy walked past with his mum, and he had a copy of 2000 AD, an old one, an old 2000 AD in his hand. And we said, where did you get that? And he said, well, there's a shop just around the corner. And we went, oh, brilliant. So we went round, and this shop had all the back issues of 2000 AD. And we were, wow, that's fantastic. So we started getting all the old issues. But they had American comics there as well. And then there was a comic book shop in West Cross Causeway in Edinburgh called the Science Fiction Bookshop. And we found that out via this other comic book shop. And, of course, we were only 13 at that time. So for us, a whole shop just with comics, we couldn't believe it. It was brilliant. So then they had a mixture of the British and the American stuff. And then they had Warrior and they had Escape there. So I don't exactly know why is it we got into this mature stuff when we were only 13, which seems really young at the time. But somehow we were. By the time I was 14, I was reading really mature stuff. And I still like that stuff now. And somehow the superhero stuff it already seemed like not particularly interesting from even way back then. What kind of stuff were you reading?
Well, I was into all these Marvel superheroes. I was, big into X-Men and Spider-Man and things like this. I had, Daredevil. I used to collect old ones going back to the 70s as well. Had them all in their plastic bags and the whole nerd collection thing. Just, I have them all stored away at home in my parents' house. And I went to, I don't know, look at one a few years ago. I hadn't opened them since for about 10 or 15 years. And I went to read one of them and I could hardly get to page 3. I was so bored. They were so juvenile. I was so surprised they were so bad. I couldn't believe it. But I have read adult comics since, maybe in people's houses a bit. they're actually really quite readable, you know. Like, I was really disappointed that my taste had changed so much, you know.
I want to say to anyone who's listening to this and who hasn't read comic books recently, please check out some graphic novels, as they're called nowadays, which basically is a posh word for a collected edition of a comic book, because you'll be surprised at the level of sophistication of the writing and the art and the artistry which is put into every element of comic books now. Just trust me, anybody who's listened to this who hasn't read any comic books in the last 10, 20 years, check some more mature ones out now. They're wonderful. You'll be surprised.
What I have been doing is I've been watching The Walking Dead. I don't know if you've been watching the TV make of that.
Yeah, the artist is called Sean on that. I know. Well, I don't know him a little bit. We've met a few times in conventions. But he's a good artist, yes. No, I like that. I like The Walking Dead. But mostly it's about human psychology, really. Don't you think so?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy as well. It's all over the top of it. But not everybody's out to kill you in a collapse situation.
That's what I was saying that when I was watching it, and I was saying to the person I was watching it with, one of the annoying things about this is they have a chance here to explore how human society would recreate itself in a non-capitalist world. Because the zombies have ended capitalism, right? And they almost completely gloss over that.
Yeah, they make everything out to be a Hobbesian kind of existence. Everybody fights tooth and nail, and there's cooperation only within a group, a small group.
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing about when people, you mentioned Chomsky before, a manufacturing consent book. The thing about this is I think most people know nowadays that the media is manipulated, but sometimes it's a shock when you realise, that's media manipulation. And the fact that they don't even consider that there might be an anarchist collective who've basically established a much better society than they were living in 10 years before when it was before the zombies arrived. The fact that they never even go into that at all, that is manufactured media consent by not even putting it into our consciousness that that could be a possibility. So that's one example of that. Whenever you see these American post-disaster type things, it's almost always that someone says, I'm the leader. And it's always, always focused on who are the key leader type figures. Whereas the kind of a collective decision making that would almost definitely happen in reality in that kind of situation, if zombies ever were to attack us, it would have to involve some level of collective decision making. But they almost never show that. It's always a presumption that the leaders would take over.
Well, I suppose they'd find it very difficult to get made if they had some radical thing.
Well, yeah, well, that's the point. And that's one of the reasons why I got fed up with filmmaking, because obviously I was a kind of independent director type writer in London, but I did work on some big movies in Shepperton Studios and Pinewood Studios and stuff like that. I worked, you know, as an assistant on those kind of things, and I have to say that those big films are like the last bastion of apartheid. I'm exaggerating it now, but it's almost like that. You've got the above-the-line people, it's called above-the-line, which is, you know, the main actors, directors, producers, and they live like white kings, whereas everyone else, the people who does most of the actual work, you know, the electricians and the extra actors and the makeup people, right, they're treated like black slaves, right? They get much, much less money, no power, very little in terms of health benefits or security. Like the extra actors, they're just left normally in halls somewhere waiting, you know, until the main actors are ready to do their scene, and then they're just piped in like sheep. And it made me kind of disgusted with the filmmaking process, that there's this horribly undemocratic process of making it. So I thought, fuck this, I'm going back to comic books, which is at least more artistically pure, where you've just got two or three people working together as equals following a creative vision.
I suppose in the comic industry, you're not in it for megabooks, you're in it for a love of art. There's not going to be that crass inequality generated when the books aren't there, you know, the money is not there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. As you know, the money and the profit creates the inequality. The fact the inequality within the films which I saw in these big studios is because there's going to have to be $50 million put in or $200 million And therefore it creates that kind of inequality within the filmmaking process too. But with comic books, of course, the publishers I work with are mainly capitalist companies in, you know, formally. But most of the time, the editors I work with, they care as much about the art as they do about the money. They try to keep the artistry as high as possible. You know, and obviously they need to sell things, but it doesn't need to make millions and millions of dollars. So we can take a chance more with comic books, which is one of the reasons I respect comic books more than filmmaking. You have that chance to be artistically edgy.
This is not for the show. I just have a question I just thought I'd ask when I just thought of it there. I was in the library and they had some manga, some Japanese manga ones, but they were in English. But they were from back to front.
Oh, yeah.
But when you're reading them, do you go from like left or right in the page back to front? Or how does it go? Because I found myself trying to just read five pages and I couldn't follow what was happening at all.
You get confused. Yeah, well, obviously this Western way that we have in Britain, France and America, etc., is going from the left side towards the right, those panels that I was talking about. So each particular page, you start in the top left in Britain and go towards the right and then go down in a Z-type fashion. And then in Japan, it's the opposite way. You start in the top right, move left, and then go back to the next right panel, move left. So there is that other way of reading. But not only that, but there's a different construction often of how you jump from one panel to the next. So you have to slightly learn how to read comic books. But that in a way shows what I'm talking about, that comic books are much more sophisticated than people think, that we have to cognitively learn how to process them with our eyes. And we're working out this information, visual and textual information. This is complicated stuff, actually. It's not simple stuff.
I was very surprised how difficult it was for me to read the manga books when they were done Japanese style. I found as if I really was unsure about what was happening at any stage.
As I say, the construction is subtly different in Japanese comic books, and they have different types of visuals in the panels, a different type of flow.
What do you mean by that?
Actually, it's not quite as different as people think it is, but the idea is that in manga, because they're often much, much longer than going for hundreds, maybe thousands of pages, they can put a panel which shows some very small, detailed visual. Like, for instance, if somebody suddenly opens the door behind me, I'm going to put my head around to see who it is, right? So as a writer and as an artist, you can show that in a variety of different ways. If for some reason you wanted to emphasize the way I change my head to look around, you could show that in one panel, or you could show it in six or seven panels. You could show the detailed element of my head turning around to see who's come in. It all depends on the feeling you're trying to create and the part that plays within the story. So manga often had a lot more panels given over to small, detailed changes, whereas American superhero ones normally had much bigger jumps.
And lots of text.
Lots of text. It's a bit silly that they're punching someone which takes half a second, but they've got about 30 seconds of conversation right next to it. It's daft. But anyway, it's fine. I mean, these are all different ways of doing it. It's all different tools in our box as comic book creators. And you can use which one is appropriate in the different circumstances. I've got your picture. I've got your picture. I'd like a million of you all around myself. I want a doctor to take a picture so I can look at you from inside as well. You got me turning up and turning down. I'm turning in, I'm turning right, I'm turning Japanese. I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so.
Recently enough, you've done some very political comic books. Why did you decide to get into writing political books?
Alan Moore's V for Vendetta. As I say, that's the kind of thing that inspires me every morning to get up and try and do good stuff myself. V for Vendetta was in Warrior, that book, which I started to read when I was 12 or 13. And so what that meant was, right at that early age, I was seeing comic books which were on sophisticated social issues. And as you can see, essentially, V is a kind of anarchist-type figure fighting against a fascist dictatorship. And the comic book is much more political, much more sophisticated than the film is. So I had that idea or that influence right from when I was 12 or 13 years old. So for me, it seemed like a totally normal thing to do comic books on social issues, as they're called. I wanted to do one on an anarchist-themed one, partly in order to learn more about it myself. Because the thing about my comic books is that the ones which are on history or autobiography or these social issues, I have to do quite a lot of research myself. I have to read the book, check out this website, listen to some debate on YouTube, make notes, discuss with the expert people who are involved about how should we do this, how should we do that. And I learn a lot in the process of making my comic books. So with the Paddy comic book, I was thinking about who could I do a book about, a comic book about anarchism with. And then I knew about the Znet site, which is one of the main progressive websites from America and the world. And so I contacted Michael Albert. This was about 3 years ago now. In fact, I think it was exactly 3 years ago, Christmas. At that time, I had the idea. And he immediately said, yeah, sounds good. And so we started working on this comic book together, which I called Paddy Comic as a joke. But it just kind of stuck. You know, when you say silly titles to yourself after you've said it 30, 40 times, it starts to become normal.
So this was a pun on his economic system he's devised called participatory economics or Paracon.
Right. And I think maybe Michael would forgive me if I said that that's basically a way of going into anarchism without calling it anarchism. It's not that. There's much more to it than that. It is a very well worked out system, but it's an anarchist socialist type way of organizing society. When he explained it to me, I thought, oh, this is very good, this is interesting. I'd like to do a book which goes into this, but also because generally people want to have stories. They want to see characters develop over time. So I thought the best thing to do would be to show Michael's personal story from 1964, 1965 onwards, and becoming an MIT student and becoming Noam Chomsky's student, and then becoming Noam Chomsky's colleague. From Michael's life from the 60s right up to now, we show the development of American radicalism in the hippie radicalism and the Weathermen and feminism and the Marxism of the time and Michael's rejection of Marxism and embrace of the more anarchist writers like Bakunin and Kropotkin, etc. And him and Robin Hanel, coming up with this variety of progressive economics and politics, which they called Paracon.
So one of the things that people give out about, say, radical left politics a lot is they say, so how would it work? This participatory economics system is kind of Michael Albert and Robert Hanel's fleshing out of anarchist or left libertarian principles into a system that could show people how the world could function alternatively.
Well, one of the good things about Michael is that he's a very, very experienced and erudite gentleman, but he reacted immediately in a positive way to this idea of, why don't we do this as a comic book? Whereas he could easily have said, no, don't be silly, that's just for children. But he has a very kind of flexible and positive way of approaching these things, because one of his main concerns is exactly that, to try and put their ideas over to people in a way that they will understand or that will get past their barriers, get past the cliches. Because as you know, anybody who's into kind of left-wing progressive politics will know that most people don't know what capitalism is. They don't know what anarchism is. They don't know what socialism or communism is. And the small minority which do have some idea, their ideas are full of cliched rubbish. When you start to talk to these people, four or five things come up. And one of them is, of course, human nature will not allow anything other than capitalism. Human nature will not allow us to be socialists or anarchists. And they state that as a fact. But then if you start to ask them, well, Why is that a fact? How do you know that's the fact? What evidence have you got for that? Or what kind of like logical reasoning have you got for that? 90% of the time, they don't have any at all. They never really thought that much about it. Occasionally, you find someone who's like a very self-aware supporter of capitalism, but it's pretty rare. So comic books is just one way of going into that. And of course, things like the Zeitgeist movie, which millions of people have watched, and Russell Brand now is maybe the most famous guy who's talking about these things in a popular way. There's lots of details that we can learn about anarchism and Marxism, and it's very, very interesting. And I'm learning myself. Now, every day I'm learning more about it. But still, the key problem that we have to face is that most people don't know what these things are, and most people are full of cliched ideas about what they are. So we need to try and get past that in some way.
It's quite a barrier. The system is set up such that it's very difficult to get coherent, radical discussion to the mainstream.
What's your experience of it there in living in London? Well, I've got one question for you, Tom. It seems that there's been a significant increase in the last 5 years of people who are thinking about alternative to capitalism. Is that your experience?
Well, it's my own personal experience. So, and I do feel as if it's a general movement among people. I consider myself somewhat of a recent convert. And you know that the newly converted are nearly always the most radical. So it's hard for me to look outside of my own experience. But I do think that there is a general increase. You know, certainly if you look to Greece and we see the rise of Syriza, and in Italy, the five-star movement, and in Spain, we got Podemos. In Ireland, we now have what looks like the two parties of the Civil War who were both centre-right now look like they might actually go into government together to stop the left in Ireland in the next upcoming election. So, you know, there's definitely, I think, seismic shifts happening. But, you know, what percentage of them are actually really radical, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's very good that that's happening. I'm glad about that. Well, by coincidence, the other book which we've done called Fight the Power, that idea came to me about a year after Paddy Comic. Because I was reading, Winston Churchill wrote a series from the 30s to the 50s called A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, right? And I thought, that's a great title. You know, because one of the things about being a writer, of course, is you start to care about words and language much more. And I liked that title, but I thought I should do a parody of that title and make it a visual history of protest amongst the English-Speaking Peoples. So that was my, again, a joke title which came to me based on Churchill's title. And we'll focus it on protest amongst the English-speaking peoples, not as his main focus was basic military leaders and war and stuff like that. And we'll make it a visual history. We'll make it a comic book version. And then I had that idea in December, January. And then the Arab Spring sprung up almost exactly in the same week that I had this idea. And then 2 months later, then the Occupy movement started. And again, it's one of these little coincidences that I had the idea to do a book about the history of protests. And then popular protests sprung up again in its largest manifestation since the late 60s. So that's the other book that we've done, which is Fight the Power. And it's about 200 years of protests in, as it says, the English-speaking world, which means in this case not just Britain, but also Australia and South Africa and Ireland too. So we've done that's the two main books which I've done of a political nature, Paddy Comic and Fight the Power.
In the Fight the Power book, you're co-authored with a lot of different writers and artists. How did that creative process work?
Well, Benjamin Dixon is a comic book pal of mine, and I thought it would be just interesting to experiment with writing one together. Him and I wrote the whole thing. And then there's three different artists, Hunt, Emerson, John Spelling and Adam Passion, who are involved. And also Pollock, the political cartoonist, was involved in it too. It actually went very easily. I wrote my chapter and Ben checked it, and he wrote his chapter and I checked that. And we found that just by coincidence our writing style and our focus was very similar. So it was no trouble at all. And the three artists' styles, they've got very different styles, but I think they mix together quite well within the whole book. I suppose I should be trying to sell some books a little bit here, shouldn't I? Is that too capitalist? Please check out the Paddy Comic book. people, if you want to see a personal history and a kind of theoretical analysis of one alternative to capitalism, which is the Paracon, and it has an introduction by Noam Chomsky, and that's the first time that he has been officially involved in a comic book. As a matter of fact, Chomsky was quite dismissive of comic books himself before, and there was an MIT professor who wrote to me saying, "How did you get Chomsky involved in this comic? Because I've been trying to get him involved in comics for 20 years. So anyway, I guess managing to persuade the world's most famous linguist to do something is a pretty good little achievement in my life so far.
No, it's quite a coup. Speaking of coups, because your book, Fight the Power, is basically set in the English-speaking world, I presume most of it, I've read parts of it now. I've read all of the Paracon book, and I've read probably about half of the Fight the Power, is focused on British imperialism. I was surprised when I moved to England how little English people were aware of the true nature of British imperialism. How did you get across this barrier? People in the UK, their history in school doesn't seem to be taught from the side of the people of the colonies too much.
Well, of course, my background is an Irish one too. So I think there's a kind of critical element in that. I think for someone who's like an Irish Scot, or an Irish American maybe in the past, they're more prone towards a kind of critical element of colonialism, you know. So like, for instance, the very first panel in the Irish chapter in the Fight the Power book is from a Dubliner's cassette, which my grandfather had. I have it now, it's right in front of me actually, he's dead now, but I have it. But he bought that about 40 years ago. And in it, it says, it's actually a spoken introduction to a Dubliner song. So your man from the Dubliner says,
"The history of Ireland is a history of oppression and the struggle of the people against it. A history of grasping landlords and conniving politicians who sought to deprive the people of their birthright.
In regular times in Ireland's past, these grievances have boiled over and the ordinary people have reacted in the only way open to them, rebellion.
Oh, wrap the green flag round me, boys, today we're fine."
So I've had that since my childhood, that kind of thing around me, with my grandfather playing those kind of songs. So for me, it's not an unusual thing, it's something that I was aware of already when I was a kid.
So tell us a little bit about how this Paracon system is designed to work then.
Well, in a way it's complicated, and in a way it's rather simple. As far as my understanding goes, and of course, obviously Michael Albert knows about it far, far more than me, but they've got basically four aspects to it, four kind of elements to the structure. And one is that it's the kind of workers and consumers council which organises things. And so this is one of the participatory elements in it. You are involved in your local worker and consumer council about what we think are the needs and the production aspects, and you can put your say towards that. It's just a very brief introduction about what that is. And the other thing is equitable remuneration, right? Obviously, one of the big problems within capitalism is people are earning hugely more than other people. But in the Paracon system, people would not be rewarded for private profit. They wouldn't even be rewarded for this kind of like natural ability. Like if some person can run faster than another one, they're rewarded according to duration of the work, the intensity of the work, and the harshness of the work involved. Those three things, duration, intensity, and the harshness or the difficulty of the work involved. What this is all aimed at, there's two other points which I'll mention in a minute, but their basic aim is so that we can organise the production and the consumption and the allocation of things in a classless way, in an equal way, which allows as much as possible all of us in the society to be part of it and to have our say and to get goods and service in a way which doesn't work against solidarity, doesn't work against diversity. This is their basic aim. Anyway, the other two elements of it is balanced job complexes. This is one of those ones which people say, oh, this is staffed, it would never work. It's not that, for instance, if you take a hospital, there wouldn't be specific doctors who only do doctor-type jobs all day long and nothing else. and then cleaners who do nothing but clean and nothing else. Because the thing about that is the Paracon system says that that creates an inequality of power. And so even if you get rid of profit-based elite in capitalism, if you're left with a kind of 20% of people who are, Michael calls the coordinators, who coordinate how things are organized, then what's the difference? They kind of just take over as a different power elite because they're the ones who are eloquent. They're verbally eloquent. They're confident. They have greater knowledge, etc., etc. So they will just take over the organizing of the society. So in the Paracon idea, you need to have balanced job complexes in which people mix empowered and less empowered jobs in a kind of roughly balanced way. Now, most people seem that silly. You can't have doctors like taking 20 hours out from doing brain surgery in order to mop the floors. But actually, if you check the way it's worked out, it's worked out in a very detailed and I think a very sensible way.
The other thing, you can imagine that if everybody had to work in the sewers once a year for a week, you know, we'd have a lot more time and understanding for the guys who have to do this job all the time. You know, just having a similar actual experience. It's easy to mentally think about something, but doing the thing it's very, very different. It changes your nature.
Yeah, well, of course, the other thing that comes up with this kind of thing, which is, again, a cliche, is that people say, well, communism was tried and look what happened. He said, they made a big mess out of it. The point is, therefore, it will never, ever work, which is a very weak point, actually. But we need to take some elements of the mistakes into account. And Michael tried to do that in coming up with this Paracon system. And, of course, Mao did that in the 60s, where he forced teachers to work in the fields, etc., etc. But, again, that's a very different perversion of the whole idea. Forcing people not to be university teachers and 100% work in the fields and then getting their children to denounce them and all, that's a horrible distortion. Nobody wants that. The balanced job complex is the doctors could continue being doctors. Professors could continue to be professors, but they also do this other type of work. So then it's not that they're forced to stop doing the intellectual work. They can continue to do that, but they do other things too to balance it. And of course people say, well, doesn't that mean you're just wasting all these professors and doctors, lawyers' brains? Right, so maybe they would be doing A, B, and C less, but we don't need to think of it in that way because the 80% of people who are not using their brains to their greatest capacity will be. So therefore, the total increase will be far greater. Even if you have 20% of people who are doing less of this specific skill, if you have 80% of people who are doing a lot more than they were, it's going to work out to be a far greater level of skill and ability which is being put into the economy. Sorry, let me just briefly mention what the fourth one is before I forget, because there's four basic parts. The fourth part is participatory planning, so that we don't plan things according to markets, as in capitalism, and we don't plan them in a kind of central way, as in the kind of Leninist, Stalinist version of communism. But there's participatory planning, where everyone is involved in the Workers and the Consumers Council in planning what we're going to do in terms of the ins and the outs of the society in that area that you're in. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure I said that before I forgot. Otherwise, Michael would be annoyed with me. He said, Sean, you forgot to say the fourth bit.
Yeah, so one thing I remember somebody making a criticism of these type of participatory economic systems was that what you were saying is that we're wasting the doctor's brain if they have to mop the floor or to clean the toilets. But it's a strange case for a capitalist to make, because if we look at the capitalist system, there's so much waste. If you think about how much do we waste on, in America, say, on defense or on war, if we give it the right name. Attacking would be a better word. The ministry of attacking.
Yes. The ministry of hitting people over the head. Yeah.
With napalm. But, you know, so like it's a very strange, like, and I think of all the jobs I personally have had in my life in different businesses, nearly all of them were completely superfluous to people's lives. You know, that there is such an amazing amount of waste in a capitalist system, that this efficiency that might be lost in some aspects of a communist, whatever type of system we want to call it, you know, that there is vast efficiency gainings on the other side.
Yeah, of course. If you think of people who do security type jobs and who stand around most of the time doing absolutely nothing, of course, there's a very simple solution to that: is allow them to read, allow them to have a book and read, and or shop assistants who fiddle around pretending to move clothes from A to B, and it's an outrageous waste of human energy and intelligence. And if you do that for 20, 30 years, imagine how your soul is sapped away from such jobs. But most people are in such jobs. Yeah, so of course it's an outrageous waste. So the fact that people have this crazy idea that capitalism is about freedom and making the most of your abilities and a meritocracy of how you can move up, when the reality of it is the exact opposite for most of us. It's amazing that most people swallow this crap about capitalism. So we'd certainly see a large increase in using our own potential in an anarchist or a properly run communist society. I think so, anyway.
Then you'll know the feel of a heart half alive when a memory's your only chance to even survive. Then just like the fool in me, you'll be spending your time living on memories, and that's such a waste of mine. Living on memories, and that's such a waste of mine.
In comic books in general, is there much left-wing political stuff? I say this because a lot of the kind of famous comic book, kind of more adult themes, a lot of them seem to be quite dark, and I wouldn't think progressive characters if you think of ones like The Punisher or ones people like this. You know, there's quite a kind of a strange pseudo-fascist element to some of these comics. You know, like the writer Frank Miller said some pretty unsavory things about Occupy movement when it happened at the time. I wonder, what's your experiences been as well in the industry? Is there that element there as well?
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird situation. I think comic books are in a kind of a 50-50 situation now. I think there's always been radical elements within comic books, but up until maybe the last 10 years or so, the kind of fanboy guy focused on superheroes was the dominant type. But that's changed now. First of all, there's a lot more women involved in comic books now. I don't think it's yet 50-50, but in Britain and America and France and Japan, there's a large amount of female comic book creators and comic book fans. So the gender element has changed a lot in the last, especially the last 10 years. And manga is one of the reasons for that. So there's a large amount of young, very smart female creators now, and most of them don't do superhero stuff. They do realistic work. There's a lady who I just recently came pals with, Carrie Fransman, and she's done one on an Iranian illegal immigrant who came into Britain. It's a true story. And so now, in the last 10 years, well, starting from the 80s, as I said, but especially in the last 10 years, there's a wide variety of comic books, and most of them are on relatively progressive political ways of looking at things. But I think I'm pretty unusual in my focus being like specifically anti-capitalist or very strongly anti-capitalist and being interested in anarchism. I'm still pretty unusual. I mean, Alan Moore's been, well, he's been into such things since the late 60s because he's that age, but even V for Vendetta, it doesn't specifically say, I don't think it says the word anarchism anywhere in it, or it might do once or twice, but it doesn't specifically mention about capitalism is something we need to fight against and replace it with anarchism. The kind of works I do are still pretty unusual. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article just a few weeks ago for the Forbidden Planet blog saying that comic books would thrive under an anarchist or much more than they do in capitalism. As we said a while ago about how comic books need to make a lot less money than films, so you've got more ability to experiment. But still, the companies are capitalist, most of them, and they do need to make a ton of profit. So the key problem, and this is one of the reasons why I can never support capitalism, is that if some good project is presented to a publisher, if they think they won't be able to turn a profit financially, the project won't go ahead. And there's so much human energy and intelligence wasted, not just by artists, but by scientists too, and teachers, and health professionals, and every kind of thing you can think of, that they have good ideas which would benefit us in some way, physically, mentally, be interesting, be useful, be healthy, but they'll not be put into operation because they'll not be able, not make a profit. So I wrote this article about how that profit motive in capitalism distorts and dampens our creative energies within comic books. I was thinking, well, how would it work? What would the alternative be? So I spoke to Michael Albert about it, and I asked for his advice as to how would comic book creators, and all artists, but I was specifically focusing on comic book creators, how would they operate within this kind of more participatory anarchist type society? So I wrote a long article about that. And to me, the comic books and all arts would thrive far more in an anarchist stroke socialist society than they do at present. That's the basic point to make.
It's so easy for us to meet our practical human needs, and we produce so much excess rubbish that we don't need. Imagine the amount of time we'd all have for creative acts under a different system.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the key things, time. One of the things that really pisses me off about that is that people think capitalism is about freedom, where it actually, it's not. Anarchism would be much more free in an anarchist society than we are in a capitalist society. And 99% of people don't realise that. This creative elements is just one example. But the idea that he can do this painting and she can sing and other people can't, it's bollocks. Everybody can do some creative thing. Right? So one of the things which is bad about capitalism is that most people don't have the time to do it, and they're robbed of the encouragement to do creative things. And when I say creative, I don't just mean paintings and art songs. I'm talking about science as well. All types of human endeavour are in general held back by the profit motive of capitalism, not encouraged. It's the opposite to what most people think.
It reminds me of a video that went viral about 3 or 4 years ago in Ireland. They were doing a Vox Populi, you know, just asking people on the street what they think about, say, the Irish government. This was at the time when the IMF were being invited in, the whole thing was collapsing. And they interviewed this old guy, just a normal guy in a shopping centre, and they asked him, would you be voting for the government, or who you be voting for? And he said, oh, I'll definitely be voting for the government. This was the first person, I think, the interviewer had met, you know, in a half an hour of asking. And he said, why would you vote for them? And he said, well, I'm an anarchist, you know, and I'm hoping for the destruction of the capitalist state. And I think they're doing a great job, so I want them to stay in power.
I like it. Oh, well, I mean, this is we're laughing now, but this is another thing, and this is a key problem, is that a key psychological problem is that people who talk about Marxism or anarchism or socialism or anything, the image is they're humorless, right? That they're too serious. People say, oh, you're taking things too seriously. Calm down. That is a really devastating criticism, actually, because most of us, especially I think British people, and this includes people from the Republic of Ireland too, is that we don't like to feel like we're taking things too seriously. You know, if we're in a pub and someone says, I don't take it too seriously, it's a big barrier on actually having an interesting, serious conversation about something, because we feel, oh shit, yeah, I better just go along with the joke, you know? So humour, funnily enough, is like a kind of conformist type humour, is one of the biggest barriers we have of improving society. Don't you think so?
There's a distinct lack of revolutionary jokes.
That would be a great thing. Because I love joking. Whenever I love to mix like serious discussions with joking. And if we could change the image of revolutionaries as being kind of funny guys and funny girls, that would be a huge improvement because people would move towards revolutionary thinking more if they thought you can be a revolutionist and have a laugh.
And not a beard.
Oh, I've got a beard right now, actually. It's more out of laziness than this.
Lazy chic.
Let me tell you a joke by Christopher Hitchens. He's talking about, this is supposedly a true story, is when Harold Macmillan and Charles de Gaulle and Madame de Gaulle were together in the early 60s. And, of course, that was the end of the Algerian War then. So the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, says to Madame de Gaulle, what do you want to do when all this trouble is over? What would you like to have? And she answers in her French accent, I would like to have a penis. And he's going, oh, a penis. Oh, you can imagine this, Harold Macmillan, conservative politician. I can't help you there. And Charles de Gaulle leans over and says, Madame means happiness.
So, Shawn Michael, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you anyway, Tom.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and Turning Japanese by The Vapors. You also heard Dubliners wrapping the green flag around themselves, Farron Young singing Such a Waste of Mind, and you are now listening to Morecambe and Wise bringing you sunshine. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega. And remember, if you want to leave a review for the show on iTunes, the instructions are included in the show notes.
Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine.